This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. President Obama has had to downsize his big plans for high-speed rail in the U.S. Several governors turned down federal funds for high-speed rail in their states, while California just approved a system to be completed by 2028. Amtrak wants to improve rail service along the Northeast Corridor and has visions of a train traveling more than 200 miles an hour that would get a passenger from Washington, D.C. to Boston in just 3 hours. The cost to build this high-speed rail system would be $150 billion, with a completion date of 2040. So what is the future of high-speed rail in the United States? We have two guests. Christopher Barkin is a professor, the director of the Railroad Engineering Program, and the George Crambles Faculty Fellow in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And Christopher Barkin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Whoops. Do we have Chris Barkin? We will get him. We do have, though, Robert Puentes, a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. He directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And Robert Puentes, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And Chris Barkin, do we have you? No, we will try to fix that. Well, let me begin with you, Robert Puentes. What has been your most memorable, enjoyable high-speed rail experience? Let's start there.
Yeah, it's most recently I had the very fortunate luxury to ride the train in Japan between Tokyo and Nagoya, and it's astounding. It's really an astonishing trip, not just because of the technology and the actual journey itself, which is, you know, it's as smooth as silk and just kind of cruises through the countryside there, but. Because of just the things that how they've put the system together, and it is such a straight and direct train, which obviously you have to do when you're traveling at very high speeds, and then you try to think about how we would interject such a system in the U.S. where we have very strong kind of land use rights, and we have a lot of built-up areas that we would have to kind of cut through. You know that the getting from here to there is going to be somewhat of a challenge, but boy, you take one trip on those and you realize that other countries have made these kinds of seismic investments that are just lacking here in the U.S.
And obviously, we are going to talk about the U.S. I'm just curious, how fast did you go on this train?
Do you know? I don't recall.
It was really fast.
It doesn't feel like you're going as fast as you think. It doesn't feel like you're getting your hair's not getting blown back or anything. but you do, you know, you can work and you can write, and before you know it, you're in Nagoya. Mm-hmm. I think the distance between Tokyo and there was about the distance between Washington and New York. The ticket was a lot cheaper and it was a lot faster.
Chris Barkin, do we have you?
Marty, I'm here.
Oh, good. I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. That kind of rocky introduction. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I've actually been able to hear you and Robert, but for some reason, you
okay.
Hear me,
well, well, we are hooked up now, and that's a good thing. I was asking Robert Puentes about his most memorable, enjoyable high-speed rail trip, and I'm going to put the same question to you.
Well, I actually rode the same line that Robert rode last month, and. Just to answer his question, I think the maximum speed out there is about 180 miles an hour or so, which is actually not the fastest in the world, but it's obviously quite fast, and it's a very pleasant ride indeed. It's hard to say. I've also had the good fortune of riding high-speed rail in a number of countries. They're all doing it very well, is I guess the way I would say it. China, Korea, Japan, Italy, France, Germany.
And the question is whether the United States is ready for a high-speed rail system. And, of course, that's a question with many different answers. But, Robert, let me go back to you because President Obama had talked about high-speed rail when he came into office. He had projects in something like 31 states. All of that has had to been scaled down. Tough economic times, of course. But do you think the country's even psychologically, politically ready for high-speed rail?
Oh, psychologically and politically, I think, are two separate issues. I do think that we're ready for the discussion. I mean, as infrastructure broadly gets pushed to the forefront of the national conversation, as we continue to talk about infrastructure in the right way, which is around economic recovery, few ideas I think are generating as much interest and enthusiasm as this idea in high-speed rail. Because we went from 0 to 60 so fast, you know, we had a lot of issues to work through. you know, particularly these issues around, well, where would these investments make the most sense right now? Given our larger fiscal and economic challenges, where can we get the best bang for the buck? It doesn't make sense to build a rail line between two metropolitan areas that don't have any economic connection between one another. So I think that getting through this initial tranche of, you know, tempering the enthusiasm with the reality that we can only do these investments in certain places has kind of forced us to think through, well, then which ones do make the most sense? Which ones, where are the places where there is political support, where there's a financial reality that can be brought to bear, and then where the politics are in alignment. And I think that there's a couple of places, again, for lots of different reasons. California does seem to work. The Northeast does seem to work. Places in the Midwest, in Illinois, seem to work. So as we go through the next couple of years and experiment with these important investments, I think we're going to learn an awful lot in this country.
Chris, let me go back to you and actually go back to California. This high-speed rail project has been approved. I think the goal is a system of 768 miles. Do you see California as a good place to put a high-speed rail system?
Yes, I do. California has been has long recognized the challenges they face, and again, that Mr. Fuentes referred to, and they need the benefits that high-speed rail can offer, both in the context of their current transportation, as well as the demand, the substantial increasing demand that they're facing, as well as other parts of the country, including the Northeast and the Midwest and elsewhere. They've, as I think people probably know, they've faced some challenges with their system and their planning, and they've recently issued a revised plan, which I think has a lot of good, more pragmatic elements that'll help them eventually achieve their goal.
You mentioned benefits. What do you see as the benefit, and even looking at California, what do you see as the benefits of high-speed rail for that state and where this rail system is supposed to go?
Well, as I said, they have already have substantial transportation demand, and that demand is projected to increase a great deal. I was reading statistics earlier about, that they're projected to add, in the next 30 to 40 years, add population to the state of California equivalent to the current population in the state of New York.
Wow.
And if you think about adding that many people to the state and what that's going to mean in terms of their transportation demand and mobility and also freight transportation demand, it's substantial. So the existing highway infrastructure, the existing air transportation capability, and the existing rail infrastructure are inadequate to handle this. Even if we weren't concerned with increasing energy scarcity and environmental impacts, and all of those, of course, are growing concerns throughout the country, and so and air quality in particular in California. So the benefits that high-speed rail can offer in terms of both providing that additional mobility, as well as doing it with reduced energy and reduced environmental impact, are quite notable, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why California has been so intent upon this as part of their future.
Robert, let me refocus our attention on the Northeast Corridor. People living in the Philadelphia area, obviously very familiar with riding trains, whether from Philly to New York or Washington to Boston. And I noticed that Amtrak has said that ridership has increased pretty dramatically along this Northeast Corridor. What's the explanation?
I don't think there's any doubt that there's some kind of rail renaissance that's going on here in the Northeast Corridor. I think as we recognize that there is this very strong economic connection between these metro areas, you know, the movement between them is going to be very important for the economies of these places and for the whole mega region. Amtrak is very fortunate in this region because it owns most of the track or all of the track between New York and Philadelphia. Between Washington, Philadelphia, and New York, and into Boston. Unlike most of the rest of the country, where they have to share it with the owners of the track, which is the freight railroad company. So, but because they've been able to invest in this region, because the system has enjoyed that for so long, there is a higher market share of folks going between Washington and New York by train than by plane. And if you've ever taken the trip, you can understand you go from the Capitol Hill in Washington to Midtown Manhattan in a pretty good clip. You're not going from a suburban airport to a suburban airport. So the fact that we have this infrastructure here in place, the fact that there is an economic connection between these places, and the fact that congestion on the roadway network and the air network is reaching pretty intolerable levels, it's not hard to see why an efficient and effective rail system is doing so well as it is here in the Northeast. So Amtrak clearly understands that this investment needs to be made, needs to be maintained, not just for their system itself, but for the economy of the Northeast.
Well, and picking up on that, and the figures that you read is something like $150 billion. I mean, if this were to become a reality, it could be completed by the year 2040. Robert, going back to you, and even just looking at this Northeast corridor, it's a very crowded corridor with lots of cities and towns along the corridor there as well. Is there room for high-speed rail?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's we can do lots of different things, but it is, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's for these trains to really meet their potential, they've got to be really straight, right? Really flat. You can't go around a lot of curves and up and down a lot of hills. You've got to do some of the land acquisition that's going to be challenging in this congested area, but there already is a very effective artery that runs up and down the corridor that needs a lot of investment, and there are some older parts of the infrastructure, the tunnel in and around Baltimore. There are places where the system is just old and needs to be fixed and maintained. Those probably should be just as much of a target of investment as some of the new stuff as well.
Go ahead, Chris. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that's actually what Amtrak's plan is calling for. In other words, they have something they call their stair-step approach to developing high-speed rail in the Northeast. And it recognizes exactly what Robert just said, which is that there are these constraints, the existing infrastructure that was built out, the original alignment, actually dates back to the 19th century. It was upgraded over the years by the Pennsylvania Railroad that owned it originally. And that's, basically what we're using today is an improved, substantially upgraded version of that infrastructure. But it does have constraints in terms of curvature. Certain parts of the infrastructure are potentially limiting the speed. And so what Amtrak is trying to do in this stair-step process is to first upgrade to the maximum extent they can the existing infrastructure so that they can increase speeds up to a maximum of about 160 miles per hour. And then their longer-term vision is this next-generation concept where they would build brand-new infrastructure where appropriate, and that's kind of that longer-range vision leading to the 2040 vision.
And I want to pick up on that after this very short break, talking about whether the U.S. is ready for high-speed rail, talking with Christopher Barkan and Robert Puentes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Nonprofit Center at LaSalle University announces 60 educational opportunities for nonprofit staff and board members. Nonprofit professionals can develop and expand their skills in fundraising, finance, management, strategic planning, evaluation, marketing, communications, and leadership through full-day classes, on-site training, and certificate programs. Now in South Jersey, too. 215-951-1701 or LaSalleNonprofitCenter.org. The Nonprofit Center supports WHYY.
Cool season grasses often need a little help at the end of summer, especially this summer. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the secrets of successfully overseeding an existing but patchy lawn, plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Four years ago in Denver, Democrats nominated Barack Obama for president.
With profound gratitude and great humility, I accept your nomination for presidency of the United States.
This week, President Obama addresses the Democratic Convention in Charlotte. I'm Mara Liasson. Join us for special coverage from NPR News.
tonight at 8 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about the pros and cons of high-speed rail, talking with Christopher Barkin. He's director of the Railroad Engineering Program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and with Robert Puentes, a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, also directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Robert, that dreaded word infrastructure that we need to care about, because obviously infrastructure is so important to the economy of this country. Looking at railroad tracks, some of the tunnels that you and Chris referred to going back to the 19th century, do we have the kind of railroad infrastructure that we can build on for high-speed rail?
We do, but again, it's gonna take some investment. I mean, it's important to temper the enthusiasm around rail with a heavy dose of reality. I mean, we do have a long way to go, to have the kind of system that was envisioned a bunch of years ago, or get to this kind of European or Asian style system. It's just not up to those kinds of standards right now. I think the Washington New York corridor, it is truly competitive. It does have this higher share on rail versus air. There are other successful routes, particularly on the West Coast, but it's going to cost us a lot of money, to put this thing in place. The recovery package gave it a real shot in the arm, gave it a real jump start, but we're going to have to start to prove the concept here, I think, before we're able to get more of that money to make those kinds of investments.
And is what about $10 billion in the stimulus package, Robert?
Yeah, it was $8 billion at the beginning, and then there were $1 billion in annual appropriations after that. So again, it seems $10 billion.
Not a mite.
It seems like a lot, but it's not. I mean, this is a system that we actively disinvested in this country for a long time, and it limped from appropriation to appropriation, and you have some states and some metros that really took it upon themselves to make sure that the system was efficient and reliable. But we've got a lot of ground to make up here.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, and let me make a point here, because people focus on the cost of high-speed rail and where the money is going to come from, and I agree with Robert about that. But it's really important to also consider what are our alternatives. In other words, how much money are we going to have to spend on the highway system? How much money are we going to have to spend on our air transportation system to gain the equivalent additional transportation capacity? And the answer is that it's probably going to cost a lot more to achieve equivalent transportation capacity with those other modes. And we'll be doing so using more energy and having greater environmental impacts, both in terms of land use, fuel consumption, air impact. And so we need to mm-hmm. consider high-speed rail as part of a package of transportation options, not as the single one that's costing all this money. They all cost money, and the nation needs greater mobility to accommodate the expansion in our population and the hoped-for improvement in our economy.
Picking up on that, and actually going back to you, Robert, and we do have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499, but I'm wondering in the interim whether it makes sense to upgrade some of the trains, for instance, used by Amtrak, to upgrade some of the curves, some of the platforms, the power system. Some of the research that I did in preparation for the show seemed to say that there were interim steps that could be done to improve rail service beyond even instituting a high-speed rail system. Robert?
Absolutely, without a doubt, without a question. I mean, we do a great job in this country of building new stuff. We like cutting ribbons in front of brand new, shiny things. There's an awful lot of stuff that's underneath that first layer, though, that has to be dealt with, not just because it's either falling apart or just needs to be rehabilitated, but for the reasons that you mentioned. There's a lot that we can do. We can add technical augmentations to different things. We can fix it, based on new realities, as you were saying, just smoothing out some lines here and there based on just the newness of the system. So that's 100% correct. But I think that what Chris mentioned is really also important. I just don't want to lose that fact that we don't treat this as a transportation system. We treat it as separate, siloed modes. We have aviation that's over here, and there's an aviation congestion problem that's dealt with from an aviation perspective. We have traffic congestion problem over here. We deal with that as a highway perspective. We have a rail system over here. And that, when you look internationally, And you look what they're doing in Japan, you look what they're doing in Germany, they don't treat it this way. We're one of the only industrialized countries on the planet that takes this siloed approach. And if we're going to get the best bang for the buck, that's got to stop.
Chris, let me go back to you, and then we'll get to our callers here. Looking at, I guess, some of the new technology, even some of what might be happening in other countries, explain to us, I guess, how a system would work, the kinds of trains, the kinds of track, where the energy would come from. Where do we stand when it comes to high-speed rail technology?
High-speed rail technology is quite mature today. That's actually one of the good things about the U.S. waiting. If there's a silver lining to this cloud, it is that we've let other nations around the world do the hard experimental work to test different systems and develop technologies that are now safe and reliable and efficient and comfortable. So what we can do is take advantage of all of that R&D that's been going on literally for a half a century in other parts of the world and adapt that to the U.S. to U.S. purposes. Now, it's also important, though, to understand that you can't just pick up technology from Japan or Taiwan or France or other nations around the world and just drop it into the U.S. environment, because there are differences here. So it's not quite as simple as a plug and play, but it is something that we can. We have experienced rail engineers in this country as well as an international community that is very eager to see high-speed rail succeed in the United States. And working together, I think we can adapt that technology to the U.S. environment.
Robert, do you want to add to that?
No, I couldn't agree more.
Okay. But what you're saying is the technology is there. We have to figure out how it would fit into a U.S. model and then do our own R&D and take, I guess, the best practices that have been used in other countries.
Let me go ahead.
Okay, fair enough. Sorry about that. let me get Keith from Wayne to join our conversation. And Keith, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for the program. Great
You're
show.
Thanks.
I've had a question really concerning high-speed rail, and that is, it seems all discussion is really about the traditional two-track high-speed rail. And the word enthusiasm was mentioned. I got to say that what really gets me excited is the potential for maglev trains. And I realize that there's probably some infrastructure concerns as far as limitations. But I'd really like to hear more about how maglev could be implemented, potentially like Southwest went when they did their airlines. They kind of didn't go to major routes, the major hubs and airports. They kind of went outside of them. And also, Marty just asked about the energy, where we get the energy from. I'm wondering what the energy after the upfront costs of building the system are considered. What's the differential in energy for powering maglev versus the traditional two-track high-speed rails?
Keith,
so anything you can talk about maglev, I'd love to hear.
Me too, and appreciate the call to Radio Times. Chris, can I toss that to you first?
Sure. Maglev has been being tested in the United States as well as other parts of the world. Notably, Germany and Japan have done a lot of research. They both have test installations of maglev. It works. There is actually one, as far as I know, system in revenue service connecting the Shanghai airport with Pudong, which is a suburb of downtown Shanghai. That said, maglev has considerable additional higher cost requirements to install and build the system. Robert was talking about the curve restrictions for high-speed rail. Well, those curve restrictions are even greater for maglev. The Japanese expect that if they build the maglev system that they're talking about building, almost all of it's going to be in tunnels because they just can't go around the mountains in Japan.
Right.
And so the problem with maglev is it imposes these extremely severe infrastructure requirements. And the additional benefits in terms of speed and service have generally led high-speed transportation planners around the world to conclude that it's not worth the extra investment. Yeah, you do get higher speed, but you also get much higher costs, and the benefits just don't pay off. In fact, the Chinese went through a major consideration of whether they were going to build their high-speed land transportation network as a maglev system versus a high-speed rail system, and after studying it and, in fact, building this connection to the airport in Shanghai, they opted to go with conventional high-speed rail technology.
Robert, do you want to add to that? I should say to our listeners, we're talking about magnetic elevation, maglev. But anything you want to add to that, Robert?
No, I think that it's certainly an idea that's it's good to talk about. I think that there is a lot of enthusiasm about this. I don't think I've been on a high-speed rail conversation where maglev doesn't come up. I think we should try to build off that and use that enthusiasm. But again, we've still got such a long way to go that I think is where Chris was going. We should continue with the path that we've gone down. We have a system that's in place that we can fix now, and that these land use, really these concerns or land acquisition concerns, are just going to prove to be really, really challenging in this country. Between Washington and Baltimore is where this maglev conversation seems to come up most often, and it's we're built up between these two metros. Sure. It's hard to see it getting done above ground.
And I guess what I hear from both of you are the words straight and flat. Is that you have, I guess, the straighter and the flatter, the better off the system works? Robert?
Straight,
yeah,
straight, yes.
Yeah, Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay.
Straight, yes, but flat, no. Actually, one of the things about high-speed rail is that it can accommodate considerably steeper grades than, say, a conventional freight train or even a conventional passenger train. And that's actually one of the kind of the basic engineering differences between the two technologies.
Mm-hmm. And that's Chris Barkin. He's a director of the Railroad Engineering Program, a fellow in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Also with us, Robert Puente, senior fellow with the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. He directs the program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And we're talking about whether the U.S. is ready for high-speed rail, and if it is, how would that system work? And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. A lot of interest in this topic. Let me get Justin from Montana to join our conversation. Justin, go ahead. You're on the air. You're on the air, Justin.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the program.
Sure.
My question is it possible to offset the cost by reclaiming old, unused track that's actually been abandoned? And is the smelting process going to be the same, or is it dependent upon different metals for the construction of high-speed rail?
Let me put the first one to Robert Puentes, the idea of, I guess, abandoned rail, whether that's more easily acquired and whether that would help to help the system. Robert?
Sure. I mean, there's lots of different ways that we can we shouldn't be thinking about this, first of all, as a giant federal program where there's going to be money raining down from Washington, right? That's kind of an older model that kind of worked for the highway system, but I don't think it's going to really work for what we're talking about here today. We need to be thinking about all kinds of different things, whether it's acquiring old land or abandoned land, or what they call land value capture, trying to recoup the increase in land value that's going to accompany large investments like this. There's a lot of development opportunities around these stations that'll arise that we can take advantage of. So nothing should be off the table. We do have the money. We do have the ability to make these kinds of decisions and make these kinds of investments. But we should be thinking about all kinds of different ways to get the system up and running.
And Chris, Justin had a smelting question that's beyond my pay grade. Can you respond to that?
I wasn't sure I understood it, but let me just speak to the general point that, yes, I certainly agree that where an existing right-of-way exists that has the appropriate curvature or straightness, maybe is a better way of saying it, that is definitely a potentially valuable resource that could be adapted for this. I think maybe the question about smelting, we wouldn't be using the existing track, the existing rail. We would just be using the right-of-way because, again, as Robert has mentioned, acquiring new right-of-way through developed areas is both financially and politically quite challenging. So that's why an existing right-of-way is a very valuable resource. The other thing I was glad to hear Robert mention is the concept of value capture. Some of the most successful high-speed rail systems in the world are making extensive use of the fact that if you build a transportation system, especially a transportation station, that becomes a magnet, if you will, for all kinds of development, whether it's retail sales, business, apartments and residential And so the value of the land can expand substantially. This is one of the really important revenue streams for one of the most successful high-speed rail systems in the world, the Taiwan high-speed rail system, where they specifically planned from the very beginning that they were going to have land set aside for the Taiwan high-speed rail concessionaire, the private entity that's built and is operating it, so that they could take advantage of the revenues in addition to the fares that they receive from the passengers. There's all this additional business development associated with the increased value of the property around the stations.
Interesting.
And that's concerning. I think we see in other countries. I mean, Chris, you mentioned in Japan. I mean, the railway company, the Japanese railway company, I believe owns not just it's a private company, owns the train system there, but in parts of it anyway. But a lot of the land, particularly around the Tokyo train station, where there's like 3 million people a day, some enormous number of people use this station, it's really a real estate deal. I mean, they own the large buildings that are there. And so it's not just the siloed way that we look at it here in this country as a train to move someone from point A to point B, but it's part of this larger system of people and the whole built environment. It's really extraordinary.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, the statistics in Japan are that the Japanese railway companies are earning something like 20 to 30% of their revenues are coming from these real estate. Mm-hmm. And that's an enormous infusion of revenues into their overall business plan.
Let me quote something that I read by Randall O'Toole. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. And he says the problem with Obama's high-speed rail is that it's an obsolete technology. It doesn't make sense today. High-speed rail was successful in Japan because at the time it was developed, only 12% of Japanese were driving. It makes no sense today when cars can go where you want to go. Just because other countries build this and are driving themselves into bankruptcy doesn't mean that we should. Clearly a critic of high-speed rail, but Robert Puentes, does he have a point, at least looking at the success of Japan and trying to duplicate that here in the U.S.?
The part of the characteristics on, you know, particularly the line that we rode between Tokyo and Nagoya, obviously very different from lots of the U.S. here, but I think the point is that we can waste a lot of money on this, right? We can put these lines in the wrong places, between places where there is no economy, where there is no market, and it's not going to magically make it an economy appear. You've got to focus on places where there's already an economic connection in order to build off of that. And so when you look at what's happened in other parts of the world and you look at what distances are optimal and where this can be really competitive, it's about, and the literature is all over the place, but about 450 miles seems to make the most sense, where you can really take a share of folks, kind of get them out of the cars and put them on the train, or where they're not going on to aviation, which is good for obviously much longer distances. So about 450 miles, where is there an economic connection? L.A. to San Francisco comes up perfectly. So about the right distance. We know there's an awful lot of people traveling between those two places. It's all within one state. You don't have to worry about interstate kind of challenges, which we need to deal with, but you don't have to worry about that in California right now. So that really should be the frame. It's not really about the particular technologies. I mean, those always have to be dealt with, but what are we trying to accomplish, and where do these investments make the most sense?
We are talking about high-speed rail today on Radio Times, taking another short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington supports WHYY. When someone is injured or ill, a long wait in the ER can be damaging. According to the Centers for Disease Control, average ER wait times are nearly 1 hour. St. Francis's Emergency Services team has worked to reduce the time to get patients into treatment rooms or to give them direct care to 30 minutes or less. More at stfrancishealthcare.org. At St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington, we specialize in you.
On the next Fresh Air, life in an assisted living facility when you're decades younger than the average resident. We talk with Martin Bain. He moved into an assisted living facility 8 years ago in his mid-50s as a result of young-onset Parkinson's disease. A former journalist and Zen monk, he now publishes a literary journal featuring writers in their 60s and older. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Banking is big in Charlotte, but it also falls hard. We'll see how an incubator hopes to broaden the city's business base. And a top Charlotte chef opens up a restaurant run by the homeless. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with the University of Illinois' Christopher Barkin and the Brookings Institution's Robert Puentes about high-speed rail. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Bob from Chestnut Hill to join us on Radio Times. And Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad to how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad to see you covering this very important issue for Philadelphia and Pennsylvania.
Indeed.
I love the discussion on the future ideas, and I think that's great, and we should work towards them. But I really like the discussion about capturing the value of what we have and fixing what we've got first.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I want to raise kind of relates to Penn Station, which I like to remind people from Philadelphia. Penn Station, New York City, it's Pennsylvania Station. And Pennsylvania hasn't had a lot to do with fixing it. And it needs to be fixed because there's only two tracks going into it, one in and one out. And people don't realize how big Penn Station is. There's 500,000 people going through there on a daily basis. It's as busy, if not busier, than Gare du Nord, which is the busiest train station in Paris. And it seems to me that while all these future ideas are great, I'm concerned that Chris Christie went and canceled that tunnel project and didn't substitute anything cost-effective in its place. Isn't that point between Newark and New York the number one priority? And what can we do to get people to focus on that and fix that first before we move forward?
Well, Bob, it's a good question. Chris Barkin, can I put that to you first and then to you, Robert Puentes?
Sure. Governor Christie, you might say, made the right decision for the wrong reason. we absolutely need a second set of tunnels into Penn Station, but we don't need the ones that were being proposed as part of the ARC project. And the reason, I won't go into too much detail, but basically those were going to be sub-end stations. They were only going to serve New Jersey Transit. They weren't going to be able to be used to serve the Northeast Corridor as the other tracks, which go through on into under the East River and into Long Island and then on into Connecticut. And so Amtrak, as part of their plan, does have, they recognize the importance. Believe me, they're dealing with the congestion in those tunnels every day. And so part of their plan is to build a second set of tunnels properly integrated with the other tracks in Penn Station and on through again to the east.
Robert Puentes is tunnels, and interestingly, Bob talks about some of these stations, about and specifically Penn Station, that needs an upgrade as well. Do you see this as part of a larger conversation about high-speed rail then?
Absolutely, and part of the economy of that metro area. I mean, I'm from New Jersey, I can talk about it this way, but I think what was frustrating to me about that conversation was that it was so focused on just this short-term issues around this particular investment and the accounting around the investment itself. And for lots of different reasons, we definitely need to do that. I mean, the state of New Jersey is facing all kinds of different challenges, so it definitely needs to talk about that. But it was just maddening that there didn't seem to be any kind of recognition of the fundamental economic connection between northern New Jersey and the city of New York. I mean, this enormous economic powerhouse here, and that if we're not dealing the crossings are legendary, and the congestion on the crossings. So that really should have been the right conversation. I think it would have. You may have not got to where you are today. You may have gotten to something that was more palatable. You may have gotten to something where there's more recognition of the kind of investment that even the investment that's made in Manhattan actually helps residents of New Jersey. I mean, that's, I'd say, a metropolitan area of which folks are going in and out every day between those two states. And that conversation was almost completely lacking. It was enormously frustrating.
Chris, I was reading about the tunnel around Baltimore is actually from the Civil War. Did I read that right?
Yep.
It was built around the Civil War time?
It was state-of-the-art transportation of the era was to build a tunnel to allow them to get under key parts of Baltimore. But that's definitely one of the major engineering and maintenance headaches that Amtrak is dealing with these days, and so a very important part of their vision, again, as Robert has already mentioned, is building a new way through Baltimore that will eliminate the problems out of this over 100-year-old infrastructure. I could go back to something else Robert said, which is referring to the economy. I appreciate the fact that he keeps bringing up these sort of the economic linkages. One of the things that is really not fully recognized about the Northeast is that the Northeast alone is the world's fifth largest economy. I mean, it's if you were to put it up against other countries around the world, it would be the fifth largest economy. And those other economies are, and already have been, investing, as we've been discussing, in high-speed rail as well as a more integrated transportation system in general. And in fact, the Northeast Corridor does represent probably our best developed integrated public transportation system, but it needs more, and it certainly needs to expand to accommodate the growth in population and the growth in that economy, as we've been discussing.
Just picking up on that, Robert, and then we'll get back to our callers, but if we're talking about an investment, is it an investment of public dollars, the price tag being something like $150 billion along the Northeast Corridor? Is it a public-private investment? How do you see paying for a system such as this?
I think everything should be on the table. The challenge that we have is that, as Chris mentioned, this is as a large economic region, that's still kind of sliced up into individual states that work pretty well together. But for the most part, we don't have the ability to make an investment or to at least recognize that an investment in, say, the Baltimore Tunnel actually benefits New York and beyond, and that the investment in the ARC Tunnel actually benefits people in Washington, D.C., and Virginia, and beyond. So that kind of conversation is missing here in the U.S. because of the governance structures that we have on the states. But in terms of paying for it, then, I don't think no one should be waiting for a gigantic windfall from the federal government anytime soon. We do know that there's private investment and there's private money out there that's landing in other countries because we don't really have the ability to accommodate it here, or it's being done in episodic kind of ways, or it's maybe one piece of the system, maybe the real estate piece, but not the infrastructure piece. So when it comes to dealing with and considering public-private partnerships in this country, the U.S. is definitely a laggard. There are some states, Virginia is one example of a state that actually has done quite well in public-private partnerships, but it's conspicuously absent, I think, in the Northeast. So everything should be on the table. We shouldn't be turning down good ideas, but we need to be able to think through, what's the best way that we can deal with those kinds of proposals in a comprehensive kind of way.
Let me get Scott from Southwest Philadelphia to join us on Radio Time. Scott, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
Subject. And one of the most important infrastructure decision in this century, in my opinion. One point that I'd like to make, and I'm really a right-of-way expert, and I'd really like to talk about some of that, but the point that you need to hear right now is that these best high-speed rail lines in the world, of which the Northeast Corridor is one of them, pay for themselves. We need to get out of the way of this. We need to set it up in 30-year bonds. The first Japanese system, the first bullet line in the world, came to Philadelphia and studied the Pennsylvania Railroad, the Amtrak, what became the Amtrak line, and then built theirs in 1963. The French followed almost two decades later. Both of these two initial lines, as most similar to our Northeast Corridor, are making money. They have paid off their construction. They have paid and they pay off their operating expenses. We need to realize that and get out of the way. It's a political problem that we have at this point. This wasn't realized just a few years ago how this was developing, but it is now. The Amtrak plan is evolving. It needs to continue to evolve. It needs to reduce some costs. We don't need an expensive tunnel in Philadelphia, unlike New York and Baltimore,
well,
where we absolutely do.
Yeah, Scott, let me take your essential point and actually put it to Chris Barkin, which is that he sees this is a system that can pay for itself. Do you agree with that, Chris?
I do, again, with the caveat that Robert already mentioned, which is it's got to be in places which make sense. But certainly the Northeast Corridor makes sense. You're going to have the ridership. You certainly are going to have lots of potential value capture from development of real estate. The successful systems around the world are are paying for their operating costs, sometimes called their above-the-rail costs, it can be more challenging to pay back the capital costs for the original investment in real estate and in infrastructure. But even there are some systems around the world that are even paying down the mortgage on that. And I certainly would agree that the Northeast Corridor is a candidate for that. And I also agree with the caller's comment that as much as possible we need to get out of the way and let the private sector do this as well as they possibly can.
Scott, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Robert, let me go back to you since you are the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan or head of the Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. We've been focusing on high-speed rail and the track system. We've done a number of shows about the sorry state for a lot of roads and bridges and highways in this country. Why have we been so lax in improving and updating our infrastructure, just broadly speaking? Your wheelhouse there, but go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to go. I mean, one is just that we've the framework for the infrastructure conversation, I think, for a while has just been the infrastructure system itself. And we used to understand, I think, the economic effect that these big investments in infrastructure make on the economy, right? And so things like the interstate highway system, things like the Transcontinental Railroad, you know, the Erie Canal, you know, airports in a bunch of different places, these were mostly framed around, you know, economic growth, right? And how we were going to put people to work in the short term and then expand the economy for the long term. And then I think we got away from that for a long time in this country. And it really took this, you know, it took a little bit before the recession, but it really took the recession to kind of push that back into the, you know, onto the forefront. There's still lots of different issues that we need to deal with in this country from an economic perspective. But infrastructure is, I think, starting to be framed in the right way, and that's a very positive thing. And it's opening up a larger conversation about what's truly transformative in which places, and it's that specificity that we have now that is making this conversation much more valuable than it has been before. We're not abstractly talking about things like like port investments or highway investments. We're talking about a highway investment here in this place. Does that make sense? We're talking about a port investment here in this place. Does that make sense? Or a high-speed rail investment in this place. Does it make sense to talk about high-speed rail in perhaps more rural parts of the country where there isn't a lot of ridership? Or does it make sense to talk about it in the Northeast and in California? That when you start being that specific and tangible, it really pushes the conversation forward in ways that we haven't before. We get then right into the financial and the funding conversations very quickly. We're still the richest country in the world. We do have the resources. But when you talk about it as an economic proposition, I think it does change the political calculus. I think people do understand, and we do see them voting for these for referendum to pay for infrastructure in lots of parts of the country. So again, we're going in the right direction, but we still have some way to go.
Chris, let me ask you something. There's an ad I have seen on TV for a freight system, and it says that this freight train can go 500 miles on a gallon of fuel. I don't want to get too wonky here. Is that true?
Yep, it's absolutely true. And in fact, this conversation we're just having about the state of our infrastructure, one of the notable exceptions to the deterioration of our transportation infrastructure is the freight railroad industry, which was deregulated in 1980 and has been pouring investment into its infrastructure for the three decades since then. And they are now, the North American freight railroad industry is considered the most efficient, effective freight railroad, freight transportation system in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we look longingly across the oceans at high-speed rail and, you know, in Asia and Europe. Those countries look at us with admiration as far as how they can make their freight railroad system better. And just speaking to that 500 mile, we were actually asked to validate the calculations that were used as part of those advertisements, and indeed they bore out. So that's I think those are a correct assertion, and it continues to get better as both train technology as well as locomotive fuel efficiency and engine efficiency continues to improve as a result of research and development in a wide range of train energy efficiency option.
Well, that's good to know. Every time I see that ad, I don't know how to calculate that, but it sounds like good news. Robert, let me put to you this idea from Amtrak, the idea of creating a train system that would get a passenger from Washington, D.C. to Boston in 3 hours. Do you think that really is doable? I don't know how old you are in your particular lifetime. Are we talking about something that really could happen, do you think?
I think so. I mean, we can do it for sure. Again, the challenges of really making those kinds of investments in one of the most congested corridors in the country is going to be fraught with difficulties. I don't want to underestimate then the governance challenges as well. You're going through seven states, six states, or something, and a whole bunch of different metro areas. So it's very complicated. But if you're going to do it, I mean, the Northeast Corridor is the place to do it. In terms of Amtrak ridership, the top three metro areas are New York, Washington, and Philadelphia. Boston then comes in sixth, right? So I mean, when you think about where Amtrak is. Where the Amtrak passengers are, and this is it, right? I mean, a lot of places. It's got a different political calculus that goes into some things which I think are obvious. But if you're thinking about, where you're going to get the best bang for the buck, the Northeast Corridor has got to be part of that conversation.
Chris, you want to add to that very briefly?
Yeah, I think there's we're doing New York to D.C. in, an Acela right now is doing that in. They're already doing that in 3 hours. They're doing that in 2 hours and 47 minutes, one Acela I'm looking at on the timetable. So I think, were we talking about New York to Washington or New York or Washington to Boston?
Well, I hate to do this only because I feel like we had a hard time getting you on the air, Chris, and now I have to interrupt you because we are done our hour. Chris Barkin, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. And Robert Puentes, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're pleasure. Very welcome. And go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.